you are.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This hour, American business post-September 11th. In the 1990s, U.S. business ran like a well-oiled machine. Markets ruled, goods flowed unimpeded, lean production meant everything was just in time. Today, it's a whole new world. First, breaking news from Geneva at an international conference on the Germ Weapons Treaty. The United States today, for the first time, publicly accused five countries of developing germ weapons and suggested other countries are doing so in secret. Earlier, I spoke with New York Times correspondent Judith Miller, a leading investigative journalist on bioterrorism and author of the best-selling book, Germs. I asked her who was on the violators list, who wasn't, and the reasons why.
Well, we're talking about what one might call the usual suspects, or what we called in our book the Dirty Dozen, which includes, among others, Iran, Iraq, North Korea, Libya, Syria. And he even threw in Sudan, though it's not a signatory to the Biological Weapons Convention. I think what was really interesting was also the countries that Mr. Bolton didn't name.
Those being?
Well, among others, Russia and China. And I understand that on the question of whether or not to name China, since they were naming names, there was quite a row at the State Department over whether or not that would interfere with U.S.-Chinese relations at a time when the United States is trying to woo that country as part of the coalition.
So we have a lot of interests intersecting here. On the one hand, we need our strategic partners in the coalition. On the other, they're publicly naming some countries, and that's unusual. What's the motivation here behind naming names?
I think it was partly because the administration is kind of tired of the dance that has traditionally been done. So on one hand, there was a feeling that this is a new post-anthrax letter era in which biological terrorism and dabbling in this kind of weaponry can no longer be kind of finessed or overlooked.
So the U.S. response would be more aggressive and in the
right
face of the suspected nations.
Literally, in this case, in your face, since the delegates from those countries are more than likely going, we're in that room.
And politics play in here as well, don't they? I mean, by putting the heat on these countries, the U.S. is taking some heat off itself. Tell us about
that. Exactly. Well, that's the secondary effect of this, which is the United States itself has been under some criticism for walking away from a protocol last summer that was designed to strengthen the treaty by adding a verification system to it. Now, the Clinton administration, by the way, had also concluded in an interagency group that the protocol was flawed and that it raised some pretty serious questions for America's biodefense efforts.
Why wouldn't the United States want inspections of alleged bioweapon efforts?
Well, because under the way in which this protocol was structured, it would wind up most probably that since the United States does a lot of biodefense activity, which is permitted by the treaty, but since this kind of activity has to be declared, we paradoxically might wind up being the most inspected country. And those countries which really have programs and which are hiding them, such as the Iran and the Iraqs of the world, would not declare anything and therefore wind up with fewer inspections. I think that also the administration felt that this protocol provided a false sense of security, which they now argue is worse than none of the advantages. Unfortunately, most of the world disagreed with the United States on this, and most of the world really wanted the United States to embrace this protocol and to go along with it.
What is it likely to achieve, upside and downside, in actually reducing the efforts to create bioweaponry?
Well, it depends on what else the administration is going to do. If you're naming names and leaving it at that, then I think the answer is not much. But I think everything we've seen from the administration so far suggests that they do take this pretty seriously and that there is likely to be some follow-up, whether it's in added diplomatic pressure or perhaps some economic sanctions or other efforts to tighten export controls of sensitive technology to these countries. I mean, I think there's definitely going to be another, to use a cliche, another shoe to drop in this drama.
Does it feel like it might be a prelude to some sort of direct action, even military intervention?
You know, the administration isn't ruling anything out in this area. And I think after September 11th and the spate of anthrax letters, it's very hard to rule things out.
And what about Russia, China, Israel, Egypt, other nations believed to be developing bioweapons?
Partly, when I asked about Russia, I was told you have to look at which way the curve is going. Russia, that is the Soviet Union, had the biggest, nastiest, most ambitious and horrifying program the world has ever seen. And now, because most of those facilities, virtually all of the ones that I visited, are either mothballed or being converted to peaceful use, that's a very impressive performance on the part of Russia.
Judith Miller, you've written so insightfully on this threat of bio-warfare. Is there a realistic hope of ridding the world of these weapons, or is this just something we're now stuck with?
I don't think there's a hope at this point, given the spread of this technology and the pent-up hatred for the United States. But you can certainly reduce it by a great many of the things that we discussed in our book, you know, investments in public health and developing new and better vaccines and developing a reliable and cheap biodetector, which we still don't have. So there's a great deal.
And what about Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda? What's being said about this terror group and its biological weapons? I know there's a lot of suspicion that the anthrax in the U.S. wasn't even from al-Qaeda. Where do they fit into the picture?
I know that Osama bin Laden has boasted that he has chemical and nuclear capabilities. Now, in what shape his network is now, whether or not such work is impossible, that's tough to say, but it does look as if the Americans have al-Qaeda and the network and Osama bin Laden on the run.
And Judith, last question. What about the mailer of the anthrax envelopes in the United States? Any progress on that investigation?
None, except that initial conclusion that this kind of looks, smells, feels domestic, and there was the FBI profile that portrayed a lone scientist with a grudge against the government and the liberal news media. This investigation is in its early stages, so I think we all have to have a little patience.
Judith Miller is an investigative journalist and correspondent for the New York Times. I spoke to her earlier from Washington. Even in the shadow of recession before September 11th, American business operated with an air of underlying invincibility. Now that uncertainty has replaced peace and prosperity, how will the streamlined companies of the 90s adjust? Companies driven by a lean, just-in-time model now need to add extra security measures and rethink ambitious globalization strategies. What changes do you see in your end of the business world since 9/11? How have attitudes shifted and priorities changed? What's driving your business today? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now in the studio is Thomas Davenport, director of the Institute for Strategic Change, a Cambridge-based think tank for the global consulting firm Accenture. He teaches at Babson College in Wellesley, Massachusetts, and is co-author of The Attention Economy, Understanding the New Currency of Business. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Tom.
And joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our news analyst, Jack Beatty, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom's both.
Hi, Jack.
Tom Davenport, you're a business guy. We're going to go point by point through the ways that you've seen 9/11 and the events surrounding it affect the ethos of business in America. But give us the overview for starters. What's the impact?
Well, I think there's a great deal of uncertainty. People are waiting to see whether something like this happens again before they make permanent changes to how they do business. But in general, everything's on hold, and we're starting to rethink some of the fundamental assumptions about how to get better at business that we made over the last decade or so.
Let's walk through some of those. You've given us a good list, and I think we're going to put this up on our website tonight for folks who want to visit there at WBUR.org. But walk us right down. Maybe this is the last PowerPoint presentation of the 90s PowerPoint festival. We're going to do it over the radio. Point one, sources of authority in the 90s and now.
Well, primary source of authority in the 90s was business, and markets were everything, and privatization was the best thing that we could do to an institution. I think that's changed, and we see that the primary source of authority certainly in the United States has become government. The big money is being spent in government. A lot of the innovation is going to happen in government, so I think we're going to look in that direction much more than we have.
Is it really that quick and that thoroughgoing? I mean, the people who grew up in the 80s and 90s really saw the markets driving everything, and it's hard to flip back and suddenly imagine the government is
that thoroughly in the saddle. But do you see that happening? Really, the momentum has shifted to the government side?
It seems that way. I mean, I was talking to a student the other day about his career plans, and I said, so, you know, what are you thinking about doing? Consulting, investment banking? He said, I'm thinking about the CIA, actually.
That's a change.
Who knows how long it will last? I think a lot of business people are sitting back and waiting to see, will this be over by Thanksgiving? Will it be over by Christmas? My own view is that it will be a long-term change.
And what does that mean for American business if the sort of big mo goes to government instead of business? After all these years in which, as you say, the market was large and in charge, what does it mean if suddenly it's government at center stage and business kind of taking government's cue? What are the practical implications of that? What are the atmospheric implications?
Well, I think practically we'll certainly move to an environment where regulation and regulatory change affects our business lives more. The smartest people will consider government as a career, which they never really did before. We'll probably have higher taxes to pay for all the things that government is doing. So I think it'll be pretty sweeping.
That's pretty revolutionary. And what about, is this the reversal of the Reagan Revolution?
I guess it is. And I think that's certainly not the kind of administration that George W. Bush would have liked to have presided over. But
We guess not.
Exactly.
But we've come to associate that kind of open, free, fast-moving market with prosperity. Can we have prosperity in a more regulated environment?
Well, Sweden is a fairly prosperous country, mm-hmm. I guess. I think we're all.
No, it struggled in the mid '90s while the U.S. pushed ahead.
It did, and I think we'll have to feel our way. This will be a new model that combines the market force with governmental authority.
We're talking with Tom Davenport. He's director of the Institute for Strategic Change, a Cambridge-based think tank for the global consulting firm Accenture, about the shape of the post-9/11 environment for U.S. business. How's it working out in your company, in your business life? You can call at 1-800-423-8255. Tom, you write about leadership, that in the 90s it was based on vision, and post-9/11 it's going to be based on trust. What's the distinction you're making?
Well, I think we expected our CEOs, our leaders in the last decade to sort of understand things better than anybody else, have the brightest mind, have the ability to analyze the situation better than anyone else. And I think we care less about that now. We care about trust. And leadership based on trust involves, being constant, no surprises. It involves walking the talk and having your actions be congruent with your words. It involves being reliable and having a lot of integrity where these leaders honor their commitments and their promises. And I think that's primarily responsible for our total change in feeling about George Bush. All of a sudden, his intellect doesn't matter nearly as much as, is he a decent guy?
We're going to come back and talk about that after a break. But before we go, Jack Beatty, I want to put that one to you. Business leaders are now going to be appraised on the basis of the trust they inspire. Is that a change, Jack?
I think it will be a change, and they'll have to change their behavior accordingly. I mean, one of the trends of the 90s has been the enrichment, self-enrichment of executives, even of, with extravagant salaries and benefits, even while their companies were failing. There's a kind of plunder going on. Peter Drucker calls it a socially unforgivable crime, whereby executives were actually profiting by laying people off. They had stipulations in their contracts that said, for every pension you eliminate, you get some more money. This kind of predatory management is the opposite of trust. And if business leaders want to be trusted, they have to act as honorable men. And in the 90s, it was a very bad year for years for executive integrity.
It was fast and loose, but it sure was prosperous. We're talking about U.S. business after September 11th, 2001. How's it changing? How's your business, your company doing post-9/11? What's changing in your management style, your boss's style, the priorities of your business? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or get into the conversation online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about U.S. business after September 11th, 2001, how things are going to change. Our guest Thomas Davenport says things are changing. There's a new face to U.S. business. How is it affecting you? Do you see it yet? Is it active in your life? Is your company, your employer, awake and smelling the coffee? And what matters now in U.S. business? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Tom Davenport, we were talking just before the break about leadership and business leadership in particular. You were saying that the 90s were about vision. This decade will be about trust. Jack Beatty raises the issue of salaries. In a time when pink slips are raining down in many parts of the country, what about those big salaries? Will they last, that huge ratio between the top guy and the or gal in the company and the bottom?
Right. It's 116-1 now on average, and I really think that can't go on. You can't have trust in people who are exploiting you to that degree. And, you know, we see some evidence of it ending. David Weatherall, the head of CMGI in the Boston area, just announced he's going to take $1 as salary over the next year. Just because this company's not doing very well, it doesn't make sense for him to profit.
Do you see existing CEOs, I guess David Weatherall is one, but do you see others seeing this reality and accepting it and going with it? Or is it going to take a new generation of leadership to step into these positions to accept less than the gigantic packages?
Well, I think there are some examples. Howard Lutnick, the much discussed head of Cantor Fitzgerald, they decided that they would take basically a 25% cut in their profits in order to provide payments to the families of the people who died on September 11th. So we're starting to see some evidence of it. I think there needs to be more.
Cantor Fitzgerald, of course, took the terrible blow in the World Trade Center along with the rest of that. You also talk, Tom Davenport, about leadership style and how that's going to change. What do you see there?
Well, I think in the 90s, we admired leaders who were kind of swashbuckling, who were willing to kind of cut through any obstacle and shoot from the hip, if you will. In the post 9/11 environment, I think it's much more a leadership style that exposes some softness. Again, Howard Lutnick was widely admired for his willingness to cry on network television, but at the same time has a certain steely resolve. We're going to stay in business. We're going to outlast the terrorists. We're not going to be deterred by what's going on in our environment.
Jack, I want to get you to respond, but let me get one more point from Tom Davenport before we do. And listeners, welcome to the conversation. Let us know how all this is playing out in your business, in your workplace, in your working life. We're talking about the future of U.S. business in this decade, how it's going to be different from the 90s. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Thomas Davenport, talk about decision-making for a second in the U.S. business environment.
Well, I think the model for decision making has always been we'll get the data, get all the facts, and then we'll make an analytical decision, based on that understanding. But in a very fast changing environment like the one that we've had for the past couple of months, you can't really have all the facts. We may be in an environment of sort of permanent uncertainty. So the decision making then becomes based on pre-existing values. You know what's important to you. So regardless of the specific circumstances, you can make a decision. And I think that's one of the reasons why we admire Rudy Giuliani so much. He's a guy who clearly knows what he thinks. He's gotten in trouble for it before, but he can act quickly and decisively based on his sense of what's really important in the world.
You do hear, I've heard many CEOs say in the last couple of months, they just don't know what comes next. They don't have enough information points of data to make decisions in a traditional way right now. Jack Beatty, you just published a history of the American corporation. What are the big changes over the last couple of decades, and what's the direction of change now? How has war affected big business in the past?
Well, to take the latter part, I mean, it has tended to help big business and hurt small business. Henry Stimson, who was President Roosevelt's Secretary of War, said, quote, "If you're going to try to go to war or to prepare for war in a capitalist country, you've got to let business make money out of the process or business won't work." And during World War II, in 1939, before the war, firms with fewer than 100 employees accounted for 26% of all manufacturing companies. By the end of the war, they were down to 19%. So business got bigger. And I think we see some of that happening now, that we have a, you know, we've talked on this program before about this stimulus package, but a piece in yesterday's Times quoted one authority saying basically these companies who are now asking for, basically they want to get us back to the 1980s when they were practically paying no taxes at all. And so, again, you see the business has seized on war as a chance to enrich themselves through lobbying. That is one of the main changes, I think, in business-government relations over the last 30 years. The soft money loophole created, ironically, by the Watergate reforms has essentially allowed corporations, big business, to dictate the terms of the American tax policy. And businesses have used the government to sort of enrich themselves, to help themselves competitively. And here, with this big crisis, they're at it again. And this is a case, I think, where the questions of trust come up once more. Because even before 9/11, according to a Business Week poll, 75% of the people thought business had too much political influence. So here we have a crisis. One of the demands of the crisis is we need a stimulus. Business lobbyists seize on that to put through a $220 billion tax cut over 3 years, which will benefit all the richest corporations in the country, but do nothing for small business. And this is the kind of thing that I think creates, you know, works against the trust that Tom was talking about. And it makes people deeply skeptical about the relations between business and government. And I think it sharpens the pre-political ambivalence that people have about business government today.
We're talking about U.S. business in the decade ahead, post 9/11, post the 1990s. We're with Thomas Davenport. He's director of the Institute for Strategic Change, a Cambridge-based think tank for the global consulting firm Accenture. Tom Davenport says a lot of change coming down the pike. Do you see it in your business, in your environment? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Bob is on the line. Welcome, Bob.
Yes, thanks for having me. I just wanted to make the comment that I believe this is being greatly overblown, primarily as a function of the media being so focused on it. And I don't believe for a minute that vision or innovation or the capitalist system is going to be impacted in the kind of way that you're talking about, that those things are somehow going to be secondary and less important because we've got to add 1% or whatever it is more to our spending of the gross national product around security-related issues.
Bob, good points, and let us put it to Tom Davenport and get his response. Hang on.
Well, there's a lot of uncertainty out there. It may be that things go back to business as usual, but it seems like we've got some people who are bent on destruction of the capitalist globalization-oriented system, and repelling them is not going to be a minor challenge. And I think it's going to be a long-term issue, and I think it will have sweeping impact.
I assume you're not saying, Tom Davenport, that vision and innovation are dead. It's a matter of what's higher in the pecking order?
Change in emphasis, I think.
Bob, what about in your business? Do you see changes in the environment that you're working in since 9/11?
Well, we saw changes before that, and I think anyone that had their finger on the pulse of the economy knew we were sliding into a recession at that point.
Sure.
And now everyone's pretty much willing to use that as an excuse about why they're not making their earnings, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is it was sudden and drastic just before the 9/11 attack. Within a couple of weeks prior to that, you know, IT budgets were freezing and things were going on hold and all kinds of things were happening, especially in the high-tech marketplace. And, you know, I just don't believe for a minute that we're not going to be able to, and I'm not saying it won't be a long-term problem, we'll be routing these people out, we'll be, you know, essentially making the life expectancy of a terrorist much lower over time, but I don't believe for a minute that that's going to somehow change the nature of government and the size of government in a great way. Certainly, infrastructure and security is a right thing for the government to be working on for us. But, you know, I think you got to quantify the problem here. And I'm not sure I've heard any quantification that convinces me that this is more than a 1 or 2% impact. You know, as we found out today, a 10% addition or $10 addition on every plane ticket.
I think, or even only $250, it may be. Bob, we take your point, and we thank you for your observation. Tom Davenport, what about it? You hear the economists say, as unsettling as all this is, the actual size in economic terms of the drag may not be significant. But you're speaking to something that is both kind of statistical and atmospheric or environmental. What do you think of Bob's observation that, you know what, this just isn't going to fundamentally change things?
Well, you know, there are some pretty big numbers. We're adding 28,000 people to the government payroll for airport security alone. I certainly don't want to speculate on things that terrorists might do next to our economy, but one could envision that if attacks were to mass transit systems, then we would bulk up on security for mass transit. And if attacks were on our critical information systems, and we'd spend a lot of money there. So I think it all depends on how much longer it goes on. If it continues and we see other instances, I think we're definitely in for a sea change.
Accenture, of course, does a lot of consulting work. Do you see your clients in a quandary about whether to assume a resumption of business as usual or something like it, or to try and project into quite a different future? Are people struggling with a fork in the road there?
Yeah, and you know, uncertainty has always been the worst situation for consultants. If times are really bad, then you bring in consultants to try to cut costs and so on. If times are really good, then you bring in consultants. It's when there's uncertainty that consultants suffer. And in general, the global consulting industry is going through its worst period in a few decades.
Jack Beatty, you hear in this conversation this kind of tension that has played out maybe across the country about whether or not to accept, to believe that we're really in a new situation here. You know, there's a temptation or maybe a realistic view that much of what the way we've lived, the way we've done business can go on. But then there's this rhetoric about radical change. And do you feel people struggling with those sort of contradictory messages?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think you can sort of see it as the news plays out, and I think the place where that becomes most apparent is in sort of thinking about globalization. I mean, just thinking concretely about it. Say you're a company thinking of direct investment, which is one of the ways in which globalization brings prosperity across the globe. Direct investment anywhere in the Middle East or Africa or South Asia. And if you were thinking about it before September 11th and you're thinking about it now, I just can't imagine that you're doing it with the same criteria. So there's an example of just how and, of course, think that through. If there's less direct investment in these countries, there's going to be less employment there. If there's less employment there, there's probably going to be more political instability from which we could get more terrorism. So it's the economic side of this. I mean, globalization has been partly the enemy for these fundamentalists, but it's also a source of prosperity for the masses, or it can be. But I think that, and I'd be interested to hear what Tom Davenport says, I think that that's where this change from 9/11 could really be felt. What do you think about that, Tom?
I think we do see the early stages of a little bit of a retreat from globalization. If you're someone in charge of moving products around the world, you look at those huge lines at the customs borders in between us and Canada and us and Mexico, and certainly as far as expansion into the Middle East and Central Asia, you've got to take great pause. So
maybe more country specific.
Exactly.
In terms of where investment goes. We're talking about the face of U.S. business in the decade ahead and how the events of 9/11 and after may change it, maybe changing it already. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Mike is on the line. Hello, Mike.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you tonight?
Real well, thanks.
I run an investment management firm.
Okay.
So I study American business and global business on a pretty regular basis. And it strikes me, a couple of points. You were talking about leadership earlier on.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, leadership is leadership is leadership. It's one of those things that you know when you see, and it's very hard to describe. I don't think fundamental leadership qualities are changing at all. In fact, I think, if anything, the need for leadership quality is as great as it's ever been, if not more so.
But Mike, do you buy that in different times, in different circumstances, different kinds of leaders come to the fore?
Yes, I guess in a case like this, very specialized leaders in specialized businesses need to be changed. But in 99.5% of the businesses that manage that are managed in America mm-hmm. and in the world, I frankly don't think so. What I find troubling is you guys are sort of accusing business of doing what it's supposed to do. In some ways, you're talking about, gee, there they go, they're at it again, trying to profit from the government's need for things. Well, isn't that the way a free market capitalist system works?
Well, maybe, but I heard the word government in that sentence, which isn't necessarily
right.
part of the free market formula.
Well, sure it is, because the government sets up all kinds of bidding processes for different jobs. If the government came out and said, look, we need some help with security. We need help with new weapons. Mm-hmm. We need help with mm-hmm. some new things. So the government simply says, give us your best ideas. If your ideas are good and they get vetted through our system, we'll pay you for those.
Mike, let me put it to Tom Davenport, and thank you for your call. Tom Davenport, Jack Beatty was saying earlier that he sees business kind of reaching into the goodie bag now that the country's in trouble. But do you see this, as Mike suggests, as the normal interplay between business and government?
Well, it's certainly a very rational thing to do. If you see that government has money, you go turn toward government. If you, in a time when venture capitalists had money, people turned toward venture capitalists. But I think it certainly represents a big change that a technology company, for example, would have as its most desirable customer the United States government. They were almost an afterthought a couple of years ago.
Mike, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, what about on the front of different styles of leadership in business? You've looked at the corporate profile. Do you see different types of leaders in different eras?
Well, we see it in politics in a clearer way. I don't know. I'm not really very good on that. I mean, it seems to me that we have tended to celebrate. There's been a cult of the leader, I think, and in recent decades, and a kind of uncritical exaltation of, say, a Jack Welch, who served one group of stakeholders, really, and served them superbly, the stockholder. But did he serve employees so well? Did he serve the community where the companies were located so well? I think of the Hudson River and the massive PC, you know, environmental reclamation that's got to go on.
But
there.
Jack, isn't it all about the competing effort to surpass one company another that makes the capitalism work, makes it efficient, makes it produce wealth?
Yes, but I'm saying that a balanced idea of there used to be a balanced notion that the stakeholders were the employees, they were the owners, and they were society. And what's happened, I think, in recent years is we've forgotten about the other stakeholders, and it's owner-driven capitalism. And that's bad for workers and bad for the environment.
We're looking at U.S. business in the decade ahead. Where's the balance now? How's your business doing? Has your boss awakened and smelled the new coffee? What matters now for U.S. business? You can call at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about U.S. business post-September 11th, after the dot bomb, after the beginnings and arrival of recession. Where is U.S. business headed? What's happening in your business with your company, your employer? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight by Thomas Davenport. He teaches at Babson College in Wellesley, Massachusetts, and is co-author of The Attention Economy, Understanding the New Currency of Business. Tom Davenport, earlier we went through the sort of biggies of your list here, leadership and sources of authority. Let's get down into some of the nitty-gritty. You talk about changes you anticipate in supply chains.
Sure. I mean, the general movement in supply chains and inventory management and logistics over the past couple of decades has been to squeeze every bit of slack out. If you have a lot of inventory in your warehouse, you're a failure as a manager. And what I think we'll start to see is putting a little bit more slack in the system, moving to a just-in-case situation rather than making everything predicated on a just-in-time delivery.
Slack so that if somehow I can't count on delivery right on time, I've still got material to work with.
Our ability to respond to a crisis will depend on what we have in the warehouse.
That's supply chains. What about supplier selection? American companies have been looking all over the world to find the cheapest, best suppliers for components that they need. What about now?
They have, and they've been moving to an environment where you could send out a purchase order on the internet and, you know, hear from 30, 40 companies and take the lowest price. When we can't count on uninterrupted supply of goods, we're much more likely to have trusted, reliable suppliers who are a short distance away, who can make sure we get our deliveries when we need them.
You've given us the goods. Let's go on. Contingency planning.
We, in the past couple of decades, really planned for failures of our buildings. We planned for failures of our technology. What we didn't plan for is massive losses of people. And if you look at an organization like Cantor Fitzgerald or many of the organizations who had substantial numbers of people in the World Trade Center, where they're really hurting is not in loss of goods or the loss of the building. It's the loss of the people. So,
But is that a real pressing concern for most companies across the country? I mean, there may be more terrorism, but what are the odds of any individual company being its target?
Well, the odds are low in every case. They were low for the organizations that did get hit. They just, you know, happened to come out on the wrong side of some statistics. But it doesn't mean you don't plan for it. The odds have always been low for lightning hitting you, but you try to avoid it anyway.
We're talking about the future of U.S. business post-September 11th. How does it look from where you stand, from where you work? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Hayes is on the line. Hello, Hayes.
Hi, Tom. I'm a student thinking about business school and careers in business.
Okay.
And, this question is for Tom Davenport. I read many of your books, and I really admire how your mind works. And you're talking about the changing face of business and leadership with trust replacing profit as motives. And
I don't think it was profit, Hayes. I think it was trust, maybe trumping vision a little bit right now. But anyway, we take your point, your question.
Okay. And I was wondering if there are any business schools that you think will be on the leading edge of teaching these new values, and if there are any specific corporations that you predict will be kind of leading the pack in this business change.
Well, business schools are usually pretty slow. Universities in general are pretty slow to respond. You know, we're still in the same semester as when all these crises happened, and it'll take a couple of years for you to start to see courses offered to help people manage in this way or deal with businesses in this way. As for corporations, I think, you know, professional services organizations who basically have to sell their smarts for a living, technology companies you'll see adapting to this new environment pretty quickly, in part because, you know, nobody else is buying their stuff, so they have to.
Mm-hmm. So no rush into the classroom with this, but you see it rolling in anyway.
Well, I'm sure, you know, smart instructors have worked in some discussion about it and maybe a little bit of case study work, but it's really hard to plan that far in advance.
Hayes, I hope that's helpful for you. We're talking about business after the 90s, after 9/11. How's it look? Jay is on the line. Welcome, Jay.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm the CEO of a venture-backed technology company.
And God bless you.
Interesting times to be this kind of a giant, this kind of a job. I was just going to offer the comment that, you know, you were asking the question, how have businesses changed?
Mm-hmm.
I would say that there's been some dramatic changes in some areas and not in others. The dramatic change is the notion of live to fight another day. A year and a half ago, 2 years ago, we had an infinite supply of capital,
mm-hmm.
and now there's no capital. The capital markets are completely closed, and the real answer is no matter how great your technology is, no matter how great your staff is, you have to conserve cash and capital as well as you can so that if things turn around and when they turn around, you're there.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, just live to fight another day. What hasn't changed is the need for communication, and communication throughout your organization and outside your organization. You have people on the outside who are worried whether you'll be there tomorrow. You have people on the inside that worry about whether they're going to be there tomorrow. And the most effective thing that we've been able to do as an organization, and by the way, we have people on the outside that we don't know whether they're going to be there tomorrow. You heard just mentioned a minute ago about suppliers. We have a contract manufacturer. Contract manufacturers are falling left and right. We have no idea whether they're going to be there. The key in this era right now is an increased focus on what do you say to people inside or outside, or what do you hear from people on the outside, because it's the only way to know what you're going to do for the next month, 2 months, 6 months, whatever it may be.
Jay, thanks for your call. Tom Davenport, that seems to go to your notion. It's about communicating trust. It's about communicating stability right now and values.
And it's about communicating in general. I think the caller was saying just the fact that you can't travel as readily doesn't mean that you don't need to talk to your customers and to your suppliers and potential sources of funding as much as possible. Now, that communication is changing. It's getting more virtual and less face-to-face, but it still has to happen.
And how are executives looking at planning, looking into the economy? The economy is so murky right now. What's the crystal ball that people look into?
Well, the old crystal balls used to be fiscal and monetary policy, basically. You know, you cut interest rates and you can assume that the economy will respond. That doesn't seem to be happening in this case. What we're facing now is a demand shock based on consumer and business psychology. So what we have to try to figure out is what will give people the confidence to buy again, both on the consumer side and the business side.
It's more psychology based. Tom Davenport, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Thomas Davenport is director of the Institute for Strategic Change, a Cambridge-based think tank for the global consulting firm Accenture. He teaches at Babson College in Wellesley and is co-author of The Attention Economy, Understanding the New Currency of Business. To see a chart outlining what Tom Davenport says has changed in business since 9/11, go to our website, WBUR.org, and click on Special Coverage. Jack Beatty, what do you think?
Well, I found his typology very interesting, especially the one, the switching in decision-making from the got to have all the facts, got to have all the numbers, to something like the gut or pre-existing values. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a whole management style, isn't there, that has to do with the numbers and the financial analyst and so on. But if you can't project decent numbers, that mode of management really is out. And the other kind, the sense of the pre-existing values, my sense of what this company is, of what we should stand for, that you can't quantify it, but great businesses have been built on it, and very few have been built on the other thing, I think, the sort of, you know, green eye shade idea. And yet that green eye shade notion really ruled in the graduate schools of business for a long time to the detriment of American business. So maybe this new change will help business.
Well, there's been a lot of entrepreneurship to it. You know what they say about leadership, that it's leaders really come to the fore when you can't see where you're headed, when you've got to have that instinctive kind of gut and faith to navigate even when the destination is not so clear. Jack, thanks for your comments. Thanks for being with us as always. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. A new prospect for peace in the Middle East, but it will take hard compromises from Israelis and Palestinians. Speaking today at the University of Louisville, Secretary of Colin Powell outlined a new U.S. policy and vision of hope and promise for the Middle East.
The Middle East has always needed active American engagement for there to be progress, and we will provide it, just as we have for over half a century. The central diplomatic challenge we face in the Middle East is to obtain a just and lasting peace between Israel and its Arab neighbors. Until Israel and all of its neighbors are at peace, our vision of the Middle East at peace will only be a distant dream. President Bush and I are convinced that the Arab-Israeli conflict can be resolved, but that will only happen if all of us, especially Israelis and Palestinians, face up to some fundamental truths. To begin with, Palestinians must accept that if there is to be real peace, Israelis must be able to live their lives free from terror as well as war. The Palestinian leadership must make a 100% effort to end violence and to end terror. There must be real results, not just words and declarations. Terrorists must be stopped before they act. The Palestinian leadership must arrest, prosecute, and punish the perpetrators of terrorist acts. Palestinians must live up to the agreements they have made to do so. They must be held to account when they do not. Whatever the sources of Palestinian frustration and anger under occupation, the Intifada is now mired in the quicksand of self-defeating violence and terror directed against Israel. Palestinians need to understand that however legitimate their claims, they cannot be heard, let alone be addressed through violence. Terror and violence must stop, and stop now. Palestinians must realize that the violence has had a terrible impact on Israel. The lynching of Israeli soldiers in Ramallah, the assassination of a cabinet minister, and the killing of Israeli children feed Israelis' deepest doubts about whether Palestinians really want peace. The endless messages of incitement and hatred of Israelis and Jews that pour out of the media in so much of the Palestinian and Arab worlds only reinforce these fears. No one can claim a commitment to peace while feeding a culture of hatred that can only produce a culture of violence. The incitement must stop. Palestinians must accept that they can only achieve their goals. The only lasting peace will be the peace the parties make themselves. Both sides will need to face up to some plain truths about where this process is heading as they turn to the challenges of negotiating permanent status issues. Palestinians must eliminate any doubt once and for all that they accept the legitimacy of Israel as a Jewish state. They must make clear that their objective is a Palestinian state alongside Israel, not in place of Israel, and which takes full account of Israel's security needs. The Palestinian leadership must end violence, stop incitement, and prepare their people for the hard compromises ahead. All in the Arab world must make unmistakably clear through their own actions their acceptance of Israel and their commitment to a negotiated settlement. Israel must be willing to end its occupation consistent with the principles embodied in Security Council Resolutions 242 and 338 and accept a viable Palestinian state in which Palestinians can determine their own future on their own land and live in dignity and security. They too will have to make hard compromises. Ultimately, both sides will have to address very, very difficult permanent status issues.
And many other partners in this effort. Jerusalem is a challenge.
They have been so helpful. They all stand behind the Mitchell Committee report. My friends, mistakes in our effort are enormous. It would be a tragedy to divert the energies and talents of another generation of young people from peace and prosperity to war and survival. It would be a tragedy to sacrifice so many more potential presidents and prime ministers and peacemakers and poets to this cruel conflict. It is time. No, it is past time to end this terrible toll on the future. It is time, past time, to bring the violence to an end and to seek a better day.
Secretary of State Colin Powell speaking earlier today at the University of Louisville. Jack Beatty, no earthquakes there, but maybe a signal from the Bush administration that it's ready to be more involved.
Well, it certainly sounded that way. And, you know, you could just read that as a very, I hate the word even-handed, but that was an even-handed analysis of the problem there. The violence must stop. The Israelis have to make sacrifices too. The Mitchell plan, which basically calls for that, the violence to stop and the Israelis to change their settlements, must be implemented to avoid what he calls this, to end what he calls this cruel conflict. An eloquent statement, I thought.
Yes, it was. Jack, thanks very much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You've been listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston.